Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
It's that time of October where it's not trick or treat, it's all treats all the way when we've got two fine folk on board. First of all, ace producer, executive producer, writer, general all-round Hollywood Renaissance man, it's Arthur Weingarten. How are you, Arthur?
Hello, Alex. Hello.
Excellent. Good to connect with your good self. And, of course, from North Carolina, keeping the social distance there with mask to the fore, it's Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
Good. How are you both?
Very good indeed, despite the fact that, well, the days and the time just seems to scoot by. Now, Arthur, I thought we'd actually, given that the Earth is spinning around at a rate of 10,400 miles per second, which is great, you know, so we're holding on tight, I thought I would actually launch today by giving a little bit of chance, really. I have in my right-hand side one TV show that you're very connected with, and I also have another TV show in my left hand. Now, which one do you want me to go for to actually lead this conversation off? Is it right hand or left hand?
Left.
Left hand. Interesting. Had you gone for the right hand, you would have actually had the Ironside episode from the second season, which actually dealt with, obviously written by your good self, a whole range of issues relating to all sorts of nefarious goings on with Raymond Burr as Chief Ironside, sorting out the spookiness of a lady who's being psyched out by a drug company, and all sorts of other bits and pieces. But we'll put that to one side, because in the left-hand side, we've got a show that you're an executive producer of. It is Maigret. Maigret, specifically, with, of course, Michael Gambon, which I was delighted to actually finally have a look at some of the episodes, because I think I missed them first time around in the 90s, and they are really very good. So my first question...
I do like them, yes, yeah.
Well, my first question to you, Arthur, is which do you prefer, being executive producer or being a writer? I mean, or is it a case of, well, as executive producer, you have to rewrite the writers in any case?
You just hit it. That's it. So it's a half a dozen or one or the other. But yeah, I mean, my executive producership was always second to the writing and actual producing. It was just a way to make some more money.
Makes perfect sense. Now, I it's the first time I've seen Michael Gambon as the Georges Simenon character, of course, of Maigret. I was aware, obviously, as you know, of Rupert Davis. I was also aware of Rowan Atkinson and, of course, Richard Harris. I thought Gambon managed to occupy the role of the Belgian detective in France quite effectively, really.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, he has the ability to be a brooding sort of character, and that's what Maigret really was. And he liked the idea of following Rupert Davies, because he grew up watching that. So he enjoyed the role.
There was definitely a connection in that, and it got me thinking, actually.
Yeah. You know, an interesting side. May I just interject?
Of course.
The only reason that Michael Gambon and you got together so you could watch him was Annette. It was she who said, you know who should play Maigret? No one else but Michael Gambon. And that was it.
Once again, the Annette André casting eye actually scores a winner, which is fantastic stuff there. Brilliant. This was a Granada television production. You were executive producer with Sally Head. Was this actually filmed totally in Granada? Was it in Budapest? Were you in Paris? What were the locations?
Budapest. Yeah, from start to finish, it was all over there, locations and the studio. And but with the British crew, with the Granada crew.
Yeah. Because, I mean, one of the things I got, and I would recommend actually, Jessica, actually check out Maigret, because it actually just seemed perfectly wonderful viewing for autumnal nights or fall nights and so on. If you basically, you know, you just want to turn the fire on or electric heater, etc., settle down, watch the episode of Maigret, it kind of flows over you in a sort of gentle vein. And I really forgot that anything was made like that in the 90s.
Yes, yeah, it's true. And if you read the books, murder, mayhem, and all of that is so far in the background. It's Maigret and how he susses out these things, but it's all really character driven, not plot driven.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it sort of opens up that whole range, which is genres and lines from that point of view as well. Jessica, are you familiar with Maigret at all as the Belgian detective, a kind of a European Columbo?
I'm not. I actually was looking it up just now. I'm intrigued, though. I'm wanting a new show to watch or a new film.
There we are. You see, you could do five. Make sure it's the Arthur Weingarten executive produced series of Granada Television. that would be a worthwhile thing for that. The other thing that struck me, Arthur, something we kind of touched on this over the years, but one of the things that Michael Gambon and Maigret has in common with, obviously, Ironside and Raymond Burr is that you've got really strong, important leading men there. And the other show, which I want to come back to it sometime, etc., is, of course, Lorne Greene in Bonanza, which, again, I have Second Sight all set and ready to go, basically, and have a little review of that. But was that something that, again, was peculiar to the 20th century? Do we still actually have strong leading? I mean, I'm thinking about obviously defining masculinity and actually being, you know, having that sort of strength of will, which is not, it's not abusive in any way, shape or form, but it basically, you get a sense that you've got a fatherly figure in charge.
I think you just literally hit the mark in dividing the two centuries, 20th to 21. In the 20th century, we still went on the concept of the hero at the center of either a novel or a play and then translated into a film. And everything went around radar-like from that epicenter. The minute the 21st century hit, we started to get into Marvel Comics time. And that's what I think it is basically today. The mass market driven by such young people with no background whatsoever in the classics or in hero-oriented drama, who is not a superhero but a human being. And that's such a divisible mark between the two centuries. Sherlock Holmes is a perfect example of bridging the gap between 19th, 20th to 21st century. By the 21st century, you had to have Sherlock Holmes doing all sorts of stuff with computers. And there went the humanity.
Yeah, interesting. And Jessica, I mean, as a Generation Z person, or Generation Z, I realize I've got not one but two Americans here, so I better actually pronounce Z as Z. It's just a thought. Jessica, what are your thoughts on this, the role of the hero and indeed heroine, I suppose?
Yes, I do think it's changed over time. I think that now there's a big emphasis put on having character flaws and more of an arc rather than kind of being this paragon of heroism. My friend and I last night, we watched James Bond, actually. We watched Skyfall, and it was kind of funny comparing the James Bond in that film to the one from the older television show, just because, you know, I think they tried to have more flaws, and it's not, the hero isn't perfect. They're a hero because they overcome their flaws.
Yes, Daniel Craig, of course, comparing with Sean Connery or even Roger Moore or George Lazenby, an interesting line. But interesting you talk about heroes, because just as you say hero, who should emerge from the whys and wherefores of Canada, etc., than the awesome Larry Nemechek, who indeed has played Dr. McCoy in a variation of Star Trek, is a keen Star Trek writer, etc. And Larry, welcome to the program. James T. Kirk, Is he kind of a hero in the same line we're just talking with Arthur Weingarten about, Ironside and Raymond Burr there, Lorne Greene in Bonanza, and indeed Maigret? Is Kirk of that pantheon of a 20th century hero, ultimately, who would probably be a little bit out of place if we were adapting him, even though he's in the 23rd century, in our current year?
Oh, I'm trying to catch up on your topic. Is he? Well, I think there's a lot of, yeah, there was a lot of James Bondian 60s about the original Kirk. And it's even interesting listening to younger fans who are talking about problematical issues with classic original Star Trek that's always either been slightly in style or you know, or on a retro cool in the 90s was the buzz, or in the aughts was the big buzz term. And a lot of people looking back at some of the 60s issues about, you know, women's issues and just now reading race into some things. But and then Gene himself making Picard a different kind of, you know, a more mature, more intellectual hero than, yeah, than a very James Bondian or James West on the Wild Wild West, if you want to keep it into, you know, but the smart but womanizing and jump in there and fist fight if you have to. Although Star Trek was, you know, no, I do not have to kill today. This is an interesting topic. Yeah, there are, and then of course you saw Kirk age through the 80s movies, and that's a different, and a lot of people carry that weight about Kirk too, but going back to watch the original series, he started off very straight jawed the first season, and then that kind of limbered up as things went along. And I would say yes, overall, yes.
A lovely reference there to Spectre of the Gun, of course, just knowing that you shall not kill today, third season episode, but well worth noting. Arthur, I know you never worked on Star Trek, but you did actually know somebody who reached huge levels of notoriety and indeed fame with respect to Star Trek, of course, Harlan Ellison. I mean, is it true that Harlan used to like to start the morning off with a litigious case when he was around?
Yeah, Harlan. Harlan was the character of characters, and I used to say to Harlan when I first met him, he came and I was story editor on a series, long forgot series, and he came in to pitch a story, and by the time we were done, I was on the floor dying laughing at things that he was saying, which he meant, that were absolutely outrageous. Completely outrageous. For example, the characters, he said, we'll call one tuna fish. Why? I asked, will we call him tuna fish? He said, well, I don't know, you'll come up with some idea, but I insist that if we do this story, you must call the character tuna fish. And the second was when I said, well, what drives these people to do what you want them to do? He said, well, Normally, you'd have a problem with it, but I know if we made them Chinese, that would explain everything. That was my introduction to Harlan, and it went downhill from there.
not great. I mean, Larry, did you ever meet Harlan in your capacity as a Trek expert?
I did just a couple of times. Well, I went to hear him talk in the 90s at a very small group back home in Oklahoma, actually, but... talked to him very briefly. His last appearance when he was at Vegas, they had just brought out a graphic novel version of his script, his original script for Sitting on the Edge of Forever. But all the legendary stories. And I worked on I was one of many contributors to the audiobook version of that and contributed an essay that a lot of people wrote to. But just the stories of how, you know, the first year of Star Trek, they reached out to a lot of science fiction authors, which had varied results. It was nice to have their names, but most of what they gave them, they were not suitable for, they weren't TV writers, wonderful, you know, imaginists, but having to shoehorn it into a producible script that Bob Justman wouldn't have a heart attack over funding and shooting. That was something else. And Harlan was in that, you know, the infamous split over the years of, he wrote his script and Gene rewrote it and all the acrimony there, but whether his original script would have ever been shot, much less been afforded, or much less the censors allowed to go on 1966 TV. So that was, you know, that was the eternal angst there. But before they got to that point, the whole first year, it seemed like they were babying him. They were so thrilled to have him there, but they'd actually given him an informal office at Desilu there, now the Paramount lot. Anyway, having the story about Gene or Bob or maybe even Herb Solo locking him in his office to get his damn draft done. And he, rather than write, he worked on jimmying the window so he could escape, come around and laugh at them for trying to, you know, lock him in his office.
I've got to ask you, Arthur, in your time with The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or The Addams Family or Honey West or any of the series you worked on, did the executives ever sort of say, we've got to take Arthur and lock him in the room before he actually writes something?
No, but as a matter of fact, you mentioned Herb Solo. I haven't thought of Herb in I don't know how many years. That was the one of the key examples of ineptness tumbling upward constantly.
Oh, do tell.
He on a script that I wrote for Mod Squad.
You know, I love that series, Arthur. Especially the cast.
Yes. Well, anyway, I was at lengths to say how Link, my nemesis on the show, how Link was affected by something, and I said that he and whomever the character was shared a long and deep kiss. And Herb Solo sent the script back with a red crayon mark to it, long yes, deep no. That was about the extent of his intellectual input.
Yeah, who would have thought it would have actually got Mission Impossible Ever off the ground, basically. But what the hey, there you go. Astounding.
Also, too, I'm now you're reminding me of these things. All sorts of angst comes back. Herb Solo, who was a lawyer, said at the beginning of every sentence, this is not a joke, this is the truth, I submit. He was in front of the Supreme Court all the time. I submit.
Yeah, I mean, Rod Serling used to use submitted for your approval quite a lot, but I think it had a dramatic sort of emphasis when Serling actually maybe less so with Herb Solo. I don't know.
Can I interrupt with one thing that I discovered just yesterday in reading a New Yorker story in a recent issue of the space trash that's floating around in space and causing all sorts of horrendous problems that we're unaware of in general. But one of the ones that's causing one of the biggest problems for the space shuttle and other things is the satellite carrying Gene Roddenberry's ashes that was sent into space when he died. And it is now in an orbit that is occupied by many of the other satellites and the space shuttle. So Gene is causing an impact even now.
That's... Heaven only knows what's happened to James Doohan's ashes either. I think he also went up as far as I recall.
I don't think they were. Yeah, I don't think they were solo. I think there were other ashes on those canisters of.
Well, I know, but I mean, I would think he claimed credit for the dominant ash. I think so. Yeah.
I mean, that is something I think even Star Trek the magazine, Larry, probably won't necessarily address and give us
investigative
journalism. We needed to know what about Gene Roddenberry's ashes.
We'll see about that. No, now you've got me. I have to go check that out and see.
Yes, and in the story, they even have the ID log number of the satellite itself, so you can track it.
I hope they're up on it. I hope they're on their toes on the space station. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you have nothing else to do with your life, you can track his ash. Yes.
Well, there's nothing going on in the world right now, anyway.
Well, that's true. That's true. Fill a vacuum. Yes. Yeah.
So let's turn to Jessica, who may actually, of the four of us, be more than likely to actually get into space before too long. Actually, Jessica, would you consider? I mean, if when you graduate, would you go for the Mars mission, perhaps?
Yeah, I'll just be over there. The first trip to Mars, I'm going to help colonize it. I don't know, space travel is such a cool concept. I'd love for it to happen within my lifetime, but I'm not too optimistic about it, but we'll see.
I mean, that's a really important point because actually, without going all sentimental, when I was Jessica's age, I genuinely thought that was going to happen. And I mean, I'm sure Larry, likewise, from that sort of point of view, and the whole excitement of the space race in the 60s and so on. I mean, Larry, is that something you listen to Jessica's words and think, well, will it? We don't know.
Well, the sad thing is, it's not so much a limitation factor of our science and our technology and our desire. It's usually about money and politics and political whims going back and forth. It's like, you know, the thing about where are the flying cars? We were promised in the 60s. And, you know,
we've got video communication, so that's a step forward.
We're all talking like this today. No, there have been a lot of aspects that have like zoomed along and medical science and technology and, you know, commercials, you know, things that can be commercialized. And we're about to maybe hit asteroid mining. And I just hope we have enough. It's like we passed all these treaties about the moon and outer space the way we did Antarctica. You know, where we're not going to compete, we're not going to compete for resources. And in the 60s, when those were done, it all felt like out of the first wave of who's going to plant their flag first on the moon. But after that initial pass, felt like that was all safe. But now we're actually getting to the point where the technology may be realized, and I'm afraid that everyone's just going to tear those treaties up and, you know, go hog wild on who can go tear up the moon. You know, even if there's not a prime directive non-warp capable species or resources that are really there, still the idea of trashing asteroids and trashing the moon and trashing Mars is because now we can, and oh, we'll just lap off the things we did because they seem Pollyanna and nice to do 50 years ago, 60 years ago. I mean, I hope we can keep some semblance of order here as we, you know, go about this. But anyway, we're getting that point. If money's going to drive it, that's the kind of thing that's going to drive. You know, hopefully we can keep pure science at the forefront of this. But just the way military defense, the Cold War was underneath the moon race, I hope, you know, just outright plunderism isn't going to drive our space now, space exploration now.
Arthur, let's turn to your good self. In terms of, I mean, I was thinking immediately when Larry was speaking there, it could be just like the Ponderosa. We could have Bonanza and all sorts of other things and stakeholders out there. You could have a gold rush and all manner of wonderful things from that point of view. Are you intrinsically optimistic about this whole system, or is it a case of, well, you know, maybe we're not meant to go to the moon again?
No, I view it as a continuum of the attention span of a fruit fly. The minute we cannot solve a problem, one wants to leave this solar system for the next one. I mean, they can't even figure out what to do with an electric car versus the gas, or with solar energy, or with God knows a million and other things. So the minute that these, quote, the people who want to leave somewhere, they leave the planet, because it's more attractive, of course. And it's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. We're killing this planet so we can move to the moon, a barren rock, or Mars, which has methane to breathe in abundance. It's just ridiculous. It's Trump's the one thing that he, as an imbecile knows, you do not have to use your brain if you have a feral instinct, and that is change the subject. Anytime you get in trouble, change the subject. And he knows how to do that. And so do all these people that argue back and forth and this and that. And it's ridiculous. They're running away from the problems here so they can create the same thing elsewhere in theory, not in practice.
In the words of William Shatner, when he was in conversation with Gene Roddenberry in the Star Trek album, Inside Star Trek, when he was asked in his persona as Captain Kirk, what would we do with the planet Earth? His line, let them suffer. I thought that was a bit harsh. You know, I suppose it's a way forward.
I remember that. No, I think there is a, I mean, I don't want to totally cheapen that. I was talking about the big bucks and the big drive, but there's of course a wave of pioneers and explorers that want to go together. They want to be on the cutting edge. They want to go where no one has gone before. And they want to pioneer purely for the science and discovery and leading the wave. But I was just talking about the reality of where our public, you know, who's focusing our attention and who's creating the mass wave and why aren't we there yet? We thought 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years ago. And hopefully we're going for the right reasons and we're doing it in the right way. But
I think we've got the slogan now, Larry. Let's do it for Jess. Okay? That's key. Yeah.
That's good to me.
If I may interject, one of the really, truly original minds, Elon Musk, who is willing to risk his own fortunes for things and all of that, basically, at the end of all time, when you write the final obituary, is that he put a Tesla car in orbit.
That's probably what's causing the problem with Gene Roddenberry's ashes.
You know? The collision there. I mean, the ludicrousness of it, the callousness of it. Here is this brilliant mind, and he then plays games by putting an actual Tesla Roadster in orbit with a mannequin behind the wheel.
But you paid attention. It got your attention.
I pay attention to cancer.
Well, that's you. I'm again here. We're talking about, you know, Mass Joe and Jill here. So,
yeah, no, I think that someone like Musk plays games with things, because I don't mean to be a nihilist, but I think he and people like you who are interested in that, and I grew up reading science fiction and loved it and all the things, the what ifs run out of road, because the what ifs can't produce the actual result, and therefore you become callous. And I think his finger went up in the middle when he sent the Tesla straight up into space. I think that's what he's saying. Brilliant, brilliant fellow, brilliant fellow. Mm-hmm. And look at the nihilism that's involved in sending a roadster into space.
But then again,
and see here, I thought it was just sheer promotional hucksterism. But okay.
Well, yes, you're absolutely right with that. I mean, I'm spinning wheels with the other, but you're absolutely right. And that's a limited edition, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Opens up a whole new world. We could go on to talk about Friedrich Nietzsche, but I think not. Let's actually get positive again. Larry, you've seen some of the wonderful work that Arthur's been involved with. Were there any of those shows, and I've cited Ironside as one of the ones we were looking to look at today, that kind of really impacted on yourself, whether it be The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Girl from U.N.C.L.E., Adam's Family, whatever, or Wonder Woman, or $6 Million Man?
Oh, see, I'm going to go back to the early, Man from U.N.C.L.E., and Girl from U.N.C.L.E. I've got a friend of mine, a colleague, that is a huge Man from U.N.C.L.E. fan and does a lot of interviewing and research when he can, and just enjoys it as a fan.
There's only David McCallum left now, of course, from that original list lineup.
He's still down in the police lab on the NCIS.
Exactly, Ducky.
Ducky. And I love when they have the meta jokes on NCIS about he looks a lot like David McCallum. It's really weird. I realized the last year or two that I apparently took away a lot more from sitcoms in the 60s and 70s than I did the one-hour dramas as a kid. But no, Bonanza.
I mean, one question I've got for you, Arthur, about Bonanza, because you were writing for it, it's season 13, season 14. And here it was screened on a Saturday evening. It's interesting, obviously, the big shock that was caused when Dan Blocker obviously passed away and sort of midway through season 13. And yet, obviously, you acknowledged his line within the passing, etc. One character who I'm kind of now appreciating, but at the time I found hugely irritating, was Mitch Vogel's character of Jamie. I mean, all the other Cartwright sort of fellows, I thought, even Adam, although he left after season 6 because he couldn't get on with the producer, apparently. But, you know, in terms of Jamie, did you find Mitch Vogel, was he somebody that you thought, I want to write for Mitch, basically?
No, I never had the slightest thought about that. No. You know, when you bring up the characters of Lauren Green and people like that, the Western concept of someone owning a huge ranch was not original, certainly wasn't. But it goes back to character. It goes back to the fact that at the very epicenter of it was a person who had a moral authority and who exerted it through progeny, his sons and this, and every story circled around that. And by the time you got to the end of that show, it had started to dissipate. And it showed it. It showed it. The weaknesses showed up.
Michael Landon was probably thinking about Little House on the Prairie. He was obviously going to help through a whole wedge of those. He was got Highway to Heaven, you know.
Right. And Purnell was a man beset by an intellect that was not right for television. Mm. He was his own worst enemy. And he and I became very, very friendly. And as a matter of fact, took a trip across the states to visit a mutual friend in San Francisco who left from New York and drove out together. It took us 2 weeks. And during those 2 weeks, I discovered a human being that was so tortured, you would not believe it. And I think of him to this day. He was a lovely, lovely person who was not made for what he did.
Well, if Purnell's up there looking down, I shall actually just point out that to hand, I do have Purnell Roberts in the Adam Cartwright. to one side. Yeah. That in the Ponderosa tin, of course, Lorne Greene, Michael Landon, and Hoss Cartwright as well. Yes, Larry, I could also geek over Bonanza as well as Star Trek. So
no, that's fine. I just love how you had it there handy.
It's always important with Zoom, I find, to actually have some props occasionally at hand to just sort of demonstrate it. Mm-hmm. Jessica has her mask, you know. Arthur has his wonderful French posters in the background, and sometimes we're out in San Diego. And you, of course, have Trekland, which is fantastic.
Well, here...
Larry's now going to demonstrate something very exciting now. Okay, and
since it's 2020, how about a virus?
Wow.
Look at that. Oh, that's impressive.
That's actually a seed pod cone from, I forget the tree, some kind of a gum tree here. Mm-hmm. But this is these are really distinctive. But this was the actual virus that Mike Okuda scanned and then made a two-dimensional representation of for the virus for the show that we sold it eventually. Anyway, after that, on Voyager, our one story sale we had after we pitched. Anyway, after the show was over, he custom did an Okuda label, you know, a joke label here, and then gave me that, and I just tried to make a little thing out of
this. This is the classic thing. And Larry, you see, it was that episode of Voyager that you wrote, of course, which clearly is responsible for the whole pandemic we're living through today.
I know. So I don't know whether I should. No, maybe I should keep this all quiet then.
Jessica, questions for Arthur or Larry. Over to you. We've got a couple of minutes left. Take it away.
I actually want to just comment really fast to Arthur that my dad actually has watched a lot of $6 Million Man, and I've watched it with him. It's a show that now I've seen before, so I just want to say it's very, very cool that you've gotten to work on it.
And Sharks as well, Jessica. Sharks. A two-part episode.
You know, I just got a residual of 12 cents for the two-part Sharks that I wrote that they turned into a feature film. And I just got 12 cents, which I think is some sort of character judgment or something.
The accountants are making way more money on this
episode than you are. Cut that check. Think about all the people involved in cutting that check and finally ending up in my hands for 12 cents.
And the postage for 50 cents.
You're right.
You had Steve Austin at sea, underwater, dealing with mind-controlled sharks. I mean, what's not to love about that? It's genius.
Right.
He's way ahead of his time, too. You were way ahead of the whole Sharknado.
Oh, yes.
You know something?
Just so I can...
I was just going to say, the television graveyard constantly yields up things that you want to forget about, and it's impossible. It's impossible.
It's the joy.
We've got 500 channels now, and we talk about the vast wasteland. It's amazing how much wasteland there was when there were only three.
Yes. You know, like, yeah, it's just
a little bit we remember today.
Absolutely extraordinary.
It's the joy of DVDs, home videos, and indeed the streaming system. Sorry, Jessica, did you have any other questions you wanted to put to the team?
How are you all doing today? Just how is everyone doing in quarantine? I have to ask.
Because for us in England, or I should say myself in England, the day's already gone. You know, I've got one more Zoomer to do with an author who's living in Calgary to talk about his life as a crime writer. And then that's it, really. But it's been a good Friday for us. What about you guys in the States?
Well, we're sitting here in the midst of a heat wave. It was 36 Celsius yesterday, and today just about the same and all of that. But nevertheless, the sun comes up no matter what. Mm-hmm. And this is La La Land. And, you know, even though you're stuck at home, we're living on the rim of a canyon with wildlife. It's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Where are you, actually?
In San Diego, in Carlsbad.
Oh, okay. You know okay.
It's down the coast.
Yes, on the north. Right.
La Jolla,
up north. No, I.
La Jolla, yeah, I'm Del Mar. All that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's 100. Well, it's going to be 100 here.
Stay in the bunker, Larry. Stay in the bunker. Stay.
You're just on the north side of LA here, Tujunga, just north of Burbank. So.
Yeah.
And North Carolina, Jessica, who obviously are ahead of the game when it comes to time zones.
Yes, we are at a nice, cool 58 degrees up here in the Appalachian Mountains. So 14 degrees Celsius. So nice and temperate.
That's something. It's a beautiful state you live in.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Beautiful. Thank you.
Are you over like the Asheville area then?
Yeah, about an hour away. Mm-hmm. Up near Blue Ridge. Mm-hmm. So, yeah,
really not the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, Jessica. Not the Laurel and Hardy Classic.
Eat the Trail of the Lonesome Pine, yeah.
Yep. Arthur, just see what actually happened when you decided to go left as opposed to right. If you'd gone right and we would have been focusing on Ironside, you went left, we started off with May Gray. It's astounding. So, clearly, A Drug on the Market, Season 2, Episode 22 of Ironside will need to wait, even though, little teaser here, stakeholders in a pharmaceutical company try to gain approval for a dangerous anti-rejection medicine just before a lucrative merger. Ironside thinks the owner knows who has been frightening her with accidents and strange voices.
Do you know what led me to write that?
No, Arthur, share with us.
The producer of Ironside was a fellow named Jack Chertock. Jack came from a long line of early pioneer film pioneers. His father was a big producer at MGM, and grandfather was this and that, and owned Nickelodeons and all of that. And Jack, God bless him, was a junkie. And he had a desk that was a pharmaceutical factory. You'd open any drawer and you could find more pills and more things that you could snort, inject, or do this and that.
He was probably just looking for a character called Mr. Tuna.
Yes, I know. And I'm not saying this to out him. Everybody knew about Jack. And we loved him because he truly was an affectionate kind of fellow who was so lost in his heritage. He knew he couldn't live up to the expectations of a father, grandfather. I mean, they were legendary, these people, and they were tough. They were tough men, these guys. And this poor fellow caved. And so one day he said to me, "Arthur, I have to cancel the meeting we're going to have. I'm in a panic. I don't have my," and whatever the drug was that he was looking at. He said, "And I'm falling apart because the company is going to go out of business." And I thought to myself, you know, a drug company going out of business usually means in the medical areas and all, oh my God, I've got to find another thing to prescribe for my patients. In this case, it was life and death. The man was looking literally at either suicide or finding another thing. And that led me to, I junked the script that I was writing. This is the absolute truth. I was writing a script about a woman who was in amnesia and slowly her memory coming back, and you'd reveal that she committed a murder. And I did it with this thing because here was a man who was being tortured. Absolutely tortured, and had a hit series on the air. I mean, you know, you can't believe things like this happen, but they did.
The title, of course, A Drug on the Market is the episode 22 of season 2 of Ironside, directed by Barry Scheer, and of course, written by your good self, Arthur Weingarten, and a series created by Collier Young. Amazing. Jessica, very quickly, we need to throw those last two questions because even Elon Musk can't stop the Earth revolving at less than 10,500 miles per second, etc., which is spinning around. So away you go, last two questions for Arthur and Larry, please.
Yes, Arthur and Larry, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer link with us today?
Well, of course, we listen to each other.
I would say even more than reasonably.
Yeah. No mention of smart here. No smart debates. No.
Oh, no. And will you both be joining us again?
Absolutely.
As soon as you'll have me, sure.
Larry Nemeshek and Arthur Weingarten and Jessica Burtis, huge thanks. Jessica, has it been good for you?
Yes, fantastic.
We will catch up with you all again in the very near future. Happy trails, and I think we'll just say, well, what Ironside didn't really have a sort of catchphrase, did he? Neither did May Gray, I suppose. Just
No. Unless you like the creak of the wheelchair. You
know, I was going to say, give me a push. That was
right. Yeah.
That's it, Larry. You've coined it. It's another series. Give me a push.
There you go.
Goodbye, all. So long.
The new tribal sheriff of Speargrass, Montana, is ex-rodeo champion Franklin Eaglechild, a man plagued with injuries from the past. His damaged health leaves him with a dim view of lost dreams. Just the opening teaser there from Speargrass Opioid, a new direction indeed for Canada's very own Dwayne Clayton. Dwayne, it's almost a year to the day since you last joined us on the Midweek Drive, and that was in the days where we were studio-based and we used telephony and various other bits and pieces. 365 days later, here we are, a year later. We've been through some changes, haven't we?
Oh my gosh, that's for sure. Who could have expected anything like this? That's for sure.
Now, just to actually clarify, before we move into Speargrass Opioid, your latest, greatest text, I've done some research in terms of Bowness, Calgary. Now, just to confirm that they're using the magical world of the internet, Bowness is a neighborhood and former town in West Calgary, Alberta, Canada. The former town was amalgamated into the city of Calgary in 1964, and the neighborhood is bordered by the Bow River to the north and east. Is that right? Have we managed to locate you effectively then?
You nailed it right on the head. That's exactly where I am, yep.
Fantastic, which is great stuff. So let's talk a little bit about this new direction, because clearly we know from your background, and obviously it's a classic case of your work as a police officer, paramedic, crime thriller writer, etc. Crisis Point, of course, was a finalist for the 2015 Crime Writers of Canada Arthur Ellis Award. Talk about this new thing. I suspect with opioids, we're possibly dealing with drugs in one way, shape or form, or is that just a red herring?
No, that's not the red herring. That's the whole crux of the story. Yeah, so the new direction was a bit of a new direction for me as well. At the end of my career, the last few years, I worked on a First Nation in Canada. And on the reservation, there was a severe opioid crisis, as there is in Canada, and I think in much of the world right now. So that was... I was right in the middle of it. We had a small ambulance service, two ambulances, and if they needed backup, I was the guy who went on backup with them. And we would go to these overdoses, and there were times when there were two or three, four people who had all overdosed, and we were working on them all at the same time. And unfortunately, the prognosis wasn't always very good. So I was right in the middle of that, seeing what was happening. And then I guess a side point to it was there's a TV show in the U.S. It's called Longmire, and it's about a sheriff in Wyoming whose area backs onto a First Nation. And so that's kind of, I took the two ideas and kind of put them together. I love the show Longmire. I like the idea of where it was placed. And so I just took the experiences of essentially the last 4 years on the reserve and combine them into a story. The story Longmire, the main character is the sheriff, Walt Longmire. In mine, I really have a 1A and a 1B kind of main character. So Sheriff Eaglechild is the new sheriff of this First Nation. And as you mentioned, he was heavily involved in rodeo and has a number of injuries from rodeo, which kind of is stopping him from doing rodeo. The other 1B character is Riley Briggs, and he is a DEA agent, drug enforcement agent, and he's based out of Great Falls. And so he's looking into the opioid crisis as well. At the same time, Eaglechild is dealing with it on his reserve. They also have a bit of a complex backstory, which I won't get into, but they do know each other from their childhood. So when they get together, they talk about old times, but don't talk a lot about work. And then... fairly early on, probably by the first third of the book, they realize that they're working on the same thing. And it'd be much better off if they worked together. And all my books lead to big confrontations and they're thrillers. So at that point, things start to speed up quite a bit in the story. And there's lots of roadblocks in their way.
Well, as the descriptor goes, Franklin soon makes enemies in high places. Friends are scarce, but luckily for Franklin, he has at least one friend he can rely on. As you mentioned, Riley Briggs, his adopted brother and DEA special agent. I mean, it almost sounds televisual. We've just actually been having a chat with our regular San Diego correspondent, Arthur Weingarten, and talking about an episode of Ironside he once wrote. I don't know if you're young enough to remember Ironside back in the day, but
I am young enough to remember that. And even Perry Mason before that.
Absolutely. Classic series, well worth accessing. In terms of that, he was talking about how he got the idea for one of his season two episodes of ISI from indeed drug abuse and aspects relating to that. And my point really is that that was written 1968, 69. Here we are in 2020, and we've still got these issues around them. I mean, great narrative, but somehow we maybe think we need to sort this out perhaps?
Yeah, we absolutely do. And I guess kind of the unfortunate thing, as you led in, you know, things have changed for us over the last year. And, you know, the drug epidemic has kind of been lost behind the coronavirus epidemic. But if anything, it's getting worse now and is forgotten. And, you know, I wish I had the answer after those 4 years on the reserve. I like to think that through my career, I was a problem solver, and I really have no clue how you would solve this problem. And it's just so entrenched in our society. As you pointed out, you can go back to, you know, the 60s, and you can go back to the late 1800s with opium, and you can go back to essentially the beginning of time with drug issues.
A slightly different point. Are you, or is there some possibility that you might actually have a universe of Dwayne Clayton, a kind of Claydenverse, in which Brad Coulter could make an appearance in a subsequent adventure for Franklin Eaglechild? I just put it out there.
That's really interesting. You know, I never thought of that. They are in two different time frames. So Brad Coulter is late 70s into the 80s. Speargrass is modern times.
I think you're more mature Brad Coulter. That's that sort of, you know, Brad Coulter, who's obviously in retirement, but maybe comes out of retirement as a 70 or 80 year old and kind of, you know, provides a sort of Yoda-like wisdom to the whole thing. Just a thought.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a great thought, because with the Brad Coulter series, I actually know how that series would end whenever it ends. And it would be with the retired Brad Coulter. And now that you've mentioned that, it would be pretty easy to have changed the location I had him retire to and make that to Montana, where he could be involved in it. So that would be an interesting crossover. I think readers would probably enjoy that, too.
Well, Dwayne, as you know, we like these interviews to be a little bit more of a sort of sharing, a collaborative sort of thing. So there we are. It all works on that sort of premise.
I'll give you credit for that one.
Speargrass Opioid, of course, your newest novel. We're also thinking about the Native American line. We do a lot of work with Native Voices, both Gene Bruscott and Randy Reinholtz, who were the co-founders of Native Voices, etc. We do thankfully have managed in the 21st century to have got away from the traditional notion of the lines of cowboys and Indians, Injun Joe, and the kind of cliched views that many ways they emerged from the Buffalo Bill character of the Wild West of the 19th century and that romanticization. And I think it's to the better. I mean, as a writer, do you think it's much better to actually have a much more rounded character than, for instance, I suppose, the character of Tonto in Lone Ranger?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think we've made leaps and bounds in that area. And with this story, I've worked very hard to portray it as accurate, to not use stereotypes, certainly to not use any of the cliches that have been associated with the areas or, you know, era you are talking about. And it's very much just about a crisis that is affecting everybody. And I've chosen a First Nation as one of the places that it's affecting, and Great Falls as another, and they're going through, you know, exactly the same things at the same time. The overdoses doesn't self-select a particular population, a particular people, or even age group.
Yeah. As we said when we spoke last year, Dwayne, I'm just amazed that you served as a Calgary police officer, Calgary paramedic, tactical paramedic, firefighter, emergency medical services chief, educator, academic chair. It's like Renaissance man in that sort of things. Has it all kind of formed a kind of holistic backdrop to the character that obviously you are now? Or were there any moments there where you thought, well, actually, I secretly quite like the days when I was a firefighter, because let's face it, the girls love the uniform. Sorry, crass point there.
Yeah. Well, actually, any of the uniforms pretty much work. I think, you know, when I was writing Brad Coulter and Crisis Point, that was going back to the idea. The premise was what if I hadn't done those other jobs? And what if I had stayed as a police officer? So in some respects, Brad Coulter's career was my what if career. What if I had stayed with the police? But it changed because Brad Coulter changed. He became less me and he became his own character. And then I think just those varied experiences, and sometimes people just felt like I really couldn't hold a job, is why I changed jobs so much. But as you said, it allows me to write from a point of realism, because I was in those situations. I know what it's like sitting in the cruiser at 2:30 in the morning in February when it's -20.
The stakeout.
Yeah, and it's just you and your partner, and nothing is happening, you know. And then experiencing, you know, those times when it's absolutely quiet and nothing is happening, and at the drop of a pin, everything changes and everything is going wrong, and you go from this kind of boredom to sheer terror in seconds.
Absolutely. Well, again, as you can tell, big Brad Coulter fan. Crisis Point, Outlaw MC, and of course, Wolfman is Back, which was published November last year, paving the way, of course, for again a change in direction and a variety of other sort of key aspects from that. Dwayne, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today, as ever. I'm pleased we managed to press the right buttons at the end of the day, because heaven only knows whether there was a moment I thought I'd have to lip read your answers. It's amazing. We got there. That's the important thing.
We made it.
Two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Oh, well, just getting to the point where we had the Zoom was interesting. But yeah, it's always great talking to you. These are great interviews. I love them.
Well, Dwayne, the next question hopefully is already in the can then. Will you be able to join? Can we prevail upon you? Will you join? Will you come back? He says. He's got to go get the words out.
You bet. Yeah. Yeah. Anytime. I've got a couple of new novels. The next two in the Coulter series are coming out in November and March next year. And then the second one in the Speargrass series, which will be called Speargrass Casino, will come out probably this time next year as well, too. So, yeah, I'd come back anytime you'd have me on.
Dwayne Clayton, author, speaker, and instructor. Huge thanks. Don't forget, you can go to dwayneclayton.com to find more details about the awesomeness from that point of view. And keep on keeping on.